and not now. By the time he wipes off the countertops a final time, it's almost 4:30, and he staggers to his room, texts Willem not to call him, and falls into a brief, brutal sleep. When he wakes, he makes the bed and showers and dresses and returns to the kitchen, where Harold is standing at the counter, reading the paper and drinking coffee. "Well," Harold says, looking up at him, "don't you look handsome?" He shakes his head reflexively, but the truth is that he'd bought a new tie and had his hair cut the day before, and he feels, if not handsome, then at least neat and presentable, which he always tries to be. He rarely sees Harold in a suit, but he's wearing one as well, and the solemnity of the occasion makes him suddenly shy. Harold smiles at him. "You were busy last night, clearly. Did you sleep at all?" He smiles back. "Enough." "Julia's getting ready," says Harold. "But I have something for you."
"For me?"
"Yes," says Harold, and picks up a small leather box about the size of a baseball from beside his coffee mug and holds it out to him. He opens it, and inside is Harold's watch, with its round white face and sober forthright numbers. The band has been replaced with a new black crocodile one. "My father gave this to me when I turned 30, says Harold, when he doesn't say anything. "It was his. And you are still 30, so I at least haven't messed up the symmetry of this." He takes the box from him and removes the watch and reverses it so he can see the initials engraved on the back of the face. SS, HS, JSF. "Saul Stein," says Harold. "That was my father. And then HS for me and JSF for you." He returns the watch to him. He runs his thumb tip lightly over the initials.
"I can't accept this, Harold," he says finally.
"Sure you can," Harold says. "It's yours, Jude. I already bought a new one. You can't give it back." He can feel Harold looking at him.
"Thank you," he says at last. "Thank you." He can't seem to say anything else.
"It's my pleasure," says Harold. And neither of them says anything for a few seconds, until he comes to himself and unclasps his watch and fastens Harold's, his now, around his wrist, holding his arm up for Harold, who nods. "Nice," he says. "It looks good on you." He's about to reply with something, "What?" when he hears and then sees J.B. and Malcolm, both in suits as well. "The door was unlocked," J.B. says, as Malcolm sighs.
"Harold!"
He hugs him.
"Congratulations! It's a boy!"
"I'm sure Harold's never heard that one before," says Malcolm, waving hello at Julia, who's entering the kitchen. Andy arrives next, and then Jillian. They'll meet Lawrence at the courthouse. The doorbell rings again.
"Are we expecting someone else?"
he asks Harold, who shrugs. "Can you get it, Jude?" So he opens the door, and there is Willem. He stares at Willem for a second, and then, before he can tell himself to be calm, Willem springs at him like a civet cat and hugs him so hard that for a moment he fears he will tip over.
"Are you surprised?"
Willem says into his ear, and he can tell from his voice that he's smiling. It's the second time that morning he's unable to speak. The court will be the third time. They take two cars, and in his, driven by Harold, with Malcolm in the front seat. Willem explains that his departure date actually had been changed, but when it was changed back again, he didn't tell him, only the others, so that his appearance would be a surprise.
"Yeah, thanks for that, Willem," says Malcolm. "I had to monitor JB like the CIA to make sure he didn't say anything."
They go not to the family courts, but to the appeals court on Pemberton Square. Inside Lawrence's courtroom, Lawrence, unfamiliar in his robes, it is a day of everyone in costume. He and Harold and Julia make their promises to each other, Lawrence smiling the entire time, and then there is a flurry of picture-taking, with everyone taking photos of everyone else in various arrangements and configurations. He is the only one who doesn't take any at all, as he's in every one. He's standing with Harold and Julia, waiting for Malcolm to figure out his enormous, complicated camera, when J.B. calls his name, and all three of them look over, and J.B. takes the shot.
Got it, says J.B. Thanks.
J.B., this had better not be for...
he begins, but then Malcolm announces he's ready, and the three of them swivel obediently toward him. They're back at the house by noon, and soon people start arriving. Jillian and Lawrence and James and Carrie and Julia's colleagues and Harold's, some of whom he hasn't seen since he had classes with them in law school. His old voice teacher comes, as does Dr. Lee, his math professor, and Dr. Caution, his master's advisor, and Allison, his former boss at Batter, and a friend of all of theirs from Hood Hall, Lionel, who teaches physics at Wellesley. People come and go all afternoon, going to and from classes, meetings, trials. He had initially been reluctant to have such a gathering with so many people. Wouldn't his acquisition of Harold and Julia as parents provoke, even encourage, questions about why he was parentless at all? But as the hours pass, and no one asks any questions, no one demands to know why he needs a new set anyway, he finds himself forgetting his fears. He knows his telling other people about the adoption is a form of bragging, and that bragging has its own consequences, but he cannot help himself.
Just this once, he implores whoever in the world is responsible for punishing him for his bad behavior. Let me celebrate this thing that has happened to me, just this once.
There is no etiquette for such a party, and so their guests have invented their own. Malcolm's parents have sent a magnum of champagne and a case of Super Tuscan from a vineyard they partly own outside of Montalcino. J.B.'s mother sent him with a burlap sack of heirloom narcissus bulbs for Harold and Julia and a card for him. His aunts have sent an orchid. The U.S. attorney sends an enormous crate of fruit with a card signed by Marshall and Citizen and Rhodes as well. People bring wine and flowers. Allison, who had years ago revealed him to Harold as the creator of the bacteria cookies, brings 4 dozen decorated with his original designs, which makes him blush and Julia shout with delight. The rest of the day is a binging on all things sweet. Everything he does that day is perfect. Everything he says comes out right. People reach for him and he doesn't move or shy away from them. They touch him and he lets them. His face hurts from smiling. Decades of approbation, of affection, are stuffed into this one afternoon, and he gorges on it, reeling from the strangeness of it all. He overhears Andy arguing with Dr. Caution about a massive new proposed landfill project in Gurgaon, watches Willem listen patiently to his old torts professor, eavesdrops on J.B. explaining to Dr. Lee why the New York art scene is irretrievably fucked, spies Malcolm and Carrie trying to extract the largest of the crab cakes without toppling the rest of the stack. By the early evening, everyone has left, and it is just the 6 of them sprawled out in the living room. He and Harold and Julia and Malcolm and J.B. and Willem. The house is once again messy. Julia mentions dinner, but everyone, even he, has eaten too much, and no one, not even J.B., wants to think about it. J.B. has given Harold and Julia a painting of him, saying, before he hands it over to them, "It's not based on a photo, just from sketches." The painting, which J.B. has done in watercolors and ink on a sheet of stiff paper, is of his face and neck, and is in a different style than he associates with J.B.'s work. Sparer and more gestural, in a somber, grayed palette. In it, his right hand is hovering over the base of his throat, as if he's about to grab it and throttle himself, and his mouth is slightly open, and his pupils are very large, like a cat's in gloom. It's undeniably him. He even recognizes the gesture as his own, although he can't, in the moment, remember what it's meant to signal, or what emotion it accompanies. The face is slightly larger than life-size, and all of them stare at it in silence. "It's a really good piece," J.B. says at last, sounding pleased. Let me know if you ever want to sell it, Harold. And finally, everyone laughs.
J.B., it's so beautiful. Thank you so much, says Julia,
and Harold echoes her. He is finding it difficult, as he always does when confronted with J.B.'s pictures of him, to separate the beauty of the art itself from the distaste he feels for his own image, but he doesn't want to be ungracious, so he repeats their praise.
Wait, I have something too, Willem says, heading for the bedroom and returning with a wooden statue about 18 inches high of a bearded man in hydrangea blue robes, a curl of flames like a cobra's hood surrounding his reddish hair, his right arm held diagonally against his chest, his left by his side.
Fuck's that dude? Asks J.B.
This dude, Willem replies, is St. Jude, also known as Judas Thaddeus. He puts him on the coffee table, turns him toward Julia and Harold. I got him at a little antique store in Bucharest, he tells them. They said it's late 19th century, but I don't know. I think he's probably just a village carving. Still, I liked him. He's handsome and stately. Just like our Jude.
I agree, says Harold, picking up the statue and holding it in his hands. He strokes the figure's pleated robe, his wreath of fire. Why is his head on fire?
It's to symbolize that he was at Pentecost and received the Holy Spirit, he hears himself saying, the old knowledge never far, cluttering up his mind's cellar.
He was one of the apostles.
How'd you know that? Malcolm asks, and Willem, who's sitting next to him, touches his arm.
Of course you know, Willem says, quietly. I always forget.
And he feels a rush of gratitude for Willem, not for remembering, but for forgetting.
The patron saint of lost causes, adds Julia, taking the statue from Harold, and the words come to him at once. Pray for us, St. Jude, helper and keeper of the hopeless. Pray for us.
When he was a child, it was his final prayer of the night, and it wasn't until he was older that he would be ashamed of his name, of how it seemed to announce him to the world, and would wonder if the brothers had intended it as he was certain others saw it, as a mockery, as a diagnosis, as a prediction. And yet it also felt at times like it was all that was truly his, and although there had been moments he could have, even should have, changed it, he never did.
Willem, thank you, Julia says. I love him.
Me too, says Harold. Guys, this is all really sweet of you. He too has brought a present for Harold and Julia, but as the day has passed, it's come to seem ever smaller and more foolish. Years ago, Harold had mentioned that he and Julia had heard of a series of Schubert's early Lieder performed in Vienna when they were on their honeymoon. But Harold couldn't remember which ones they had loved, and so he had made up his own list and augmented it with a few other songs he liked, mostly Bach and Mozart, and then rented a small sound booth and recorded a disc of himself singing them. Every few months or so, Harold asks for him to sing them, but he's always too shy to do so. Now, though, the gift feels misguided and tinny, as well as shamefully boastful, and he is embarrassed by his own presumption. Yet he can't bring himself to throw it away. And so when everyone is standing and stretching and saying their goodnights, he slips away and wedges the disc and the letters he's written each of them between two books, a battered copy of Common Sense and a frayed edition of White Noise, on a low shelf where they might sit undiscovered for decades. Normally, Willem stays with J.B. in the upstairs study, as he's the only one who can tolerate J.B.'s snoring, and Malcolm stays with him downstairs. But that evening, as everyone heads off for bed, Malcolm volunteers that he'll share with J.B. so that he and Willem can catch up with each other.
Night lovers,
J.B. calls down the staircase at them. As they get ready for bed, Willem tells him more stories from the set. About the lead actress, who perspired so much that her entire face had to be dusted with powder every two takes. About the lead actor, who played the devil,
and who was constantly trying to curry favor with the Grips by buying them beers and asking them who wanted to play football, but who then had a tantrum when he couldn't remember his lines. About the 9-year-old British actor playing the actress's son, who had approached Willem at the craft services table to tell him that he really shouldn't be eating crackers because they were empty calories, and wasn't he afraid of getting fat? Willem talks and talks, and he laughs as he brushes his teeth and washes his face. But when the lights are turned off and they are both lying in the dark, he in the bed, Willem on the sofa, after an argument in which he tried to get Willem to take the bed himself, Willem says gently, "The apartment's really fucking clean." "I know," he winces. "I'm sorry."
"Don't be," Willem says. "But Jude, was it really awful?"
He understands then that Andy did tell Willem at least some of what had happened, and so he decides to answer honestly.
"It wasn't great," he allows,
and then, because he doesn't want Willem to feel guilty,
"but it wasn't horrible."
They are both quiet.
"I wish I could have been there," Willem says.
"You were," he assures him.
"But Willem, I missed you."
Very quietly, Willem says,
"I missed you too. Thank you for coming," he says.
"Of course I was going to come, Judy," Willem says from across the room. "I would have no matter what." He is silent, savoring this promise and committing it to memory so he can think about it in moments when he needs it most.
"Do you think it went all right?" he asks.
"Are you serious?" Willem says, and he can hear him sit up.
"Did you see Harold's face? He looked like the Green Party just elected its first president and the Second Amendment was eliminated and the Red Sox were canonized all in the same day."
He laughs.
"You really think so?"
"I know so. He was really, really happy, Jude. He loves you." He smiles into the dark. He wants to hear Willem say such things over and over, an endless loop of promises and avowals, but he knows such wishes are self-indulgent, and so he changes the subject, and they talk of little things, nothings, until first Willem and then he fall asleep. A week later, his giddiness has mellowed into something else, a contentment, a stillness. For the past week, his nights have been unbroken stretches of sleep in which he dreams not of the past, but of the present. Silly dreams about work, suddenly absurd dreams about his friends. It is the first complete week in the now almost 2 decades since he began cutting himself that he hasn't woken in the middle of the night, since he's felt no need for the razor. Maybe he is cured, he dares to think. Maybe this is what he needed all along, and now that it's happened, he is better. He feels wonderful, like a different person, whole and healthy and calm. He is someone's son, and at times the knowledge of that is so overwhelming that he imagines it is manifesting itself physically, as if it's been written in something shining and gold across his chest. He is back in their apartment. Willem is with him. He has brought back with him a second statue of St. Jude, which they keep in the kitchen, but this St. Jude is bigger and hollow and ceramic, with a slot chiseled into the back of his head, and they feed their change through it at the end of the day. When it's full, they decide they'll go buy a really good bottle of wine and drink it, and then they'll begin again. He doesn't know this now, but in the years to come he will again and again test Harold's claims of devotion, will throw himself against his promises to see how steadfast they are. He won't even be conscious that he's doing this, but he will do it anyway, because part of him will never believe Harold and Julia. As much as he wants to, as much as he thinks he does, he won't, and he will always be convinced that they will eventually tire of him, and that they will one day regret their involvement with him. And so he will challenge them, because when their relationship inevitably ends, he will be able to look back and know for certain that he caused it, and not only that, but the specific incident that caused it, and he will never have to wonder or worry about what he did wrong or what he could have done better.
but that is in the future. For now, his happiness is flawless. That first Saturday after he returns from Boston, he goes up to Felix's house as usual, where Mr. Baker has requested he come a few minutes early. They talk briefly, and he goes downstairs to find Felix, who is waiting for him in the music room, plinking at the piano keys. "So, Felix," he says, in the break they take after piano and Latin, but before German and math, "your father tells me you're going away to school next year."
"Yeah," says Felix, looking down at his feet. "In September. Dad went there, too."
"I heard," he says. "How do you feel about it?"
Felix shrugs.
"I don't know," he says at last. "Dad says you're going to catch me up this spring and summer."
"I will," he promises.
"You're going to be so ready for that school that they won't know what hit them."
Felix's head is still bent, but he sees the tops of his cheeks fatten a little and knows he's smiling just a bit. He doesn't know what makes him say what he does next. Is it empathy, as he hopes, or is it a boast? And alluding aloud to the improbable and wondrous turns his life has taken over the past month.
"You know, Felix," he begins, "I never had friends either. Not for a very long time. Not until I was much older than you."
He can sense, rather than see, Felix become alert, can feel him listening.
"I wanted them too," he continues, going slowly now, because he wants to make sure his words come out right. "And I always wondered if I would ever find any, and how, and when."
He traces his index finger across the dark walnut tabletop, up the spine of Felix's math textbook, down his cold glass of water.
"And then I went to college, and I met people who, for whatever reason, decided to be my friends. And they taught me everything, really. They made me, and make me, into someone better than I really am. You won't understand what I mean now, but someday you will. The only trick of friendship, I think, is to find people who are better than you are. Not smarter, not cooler, but kinder and more generous and more forgiving. And then to appreciate them for what they can teach you, and to try to listen to them when they tell you something about yourself, no matter how bad or good it might be, and to trust them, which is the hardest thing of all, but the best as well."
They're both quiet for a long time, listening to the click of the metronome, which is faulty and sometimes starts ticking spontaneously, even after he stopped it.
"You're going to make friends, Felix," he says finally. "You will. You won't have to work as hard at finding them as you will at keeping them, but I promise it'll be work worth doing. Far more worth doing than, say, Latin."
And now Felix looks up at him and smiles, and he smiles back.
"Okay?"
he asks him.
"Okay,"
Felix says, still smiling.
"What do you want to do next, German or math?"
"Math," says Felix.
"Good choice," he says,
and pulls Felix's math book over to him.
"Let's pick up where we left off last time."
And Felix turns to the page, and they begin. Part 3. Vanities. Chapter 1. Their next-door suitemates, their second year in Hood, had been a trio of lesbians, all seniors, who had been in a band called Backfat, and had, for some reason, taken a liking to J.B., and eventually Jude, and then Willem, and finally, reluctantly, Malcolm. Now, 15 years after the four of them had graduated, two of the lesbians had coupled up and were living in Brooklyn. Of the four of them, only J.B. talked to them regularly. Marta was a non-profit labor lawyer, and Francesca was a set designer. "Exciting news," J.B. told them one Friday in October over dinner. "The bitches of Bushwick called. Edie's in town." Edie was the third of the lesbians' trio, a beefy, emotional Korean-American who shuttled back and forth between San Francisco and New York and seemed always to be preparing for
one improbable job or another. The last time they had seen her, she was about to leave for Grasse to begin training to become a professional nose, and just 8 months before that, she had finished a cooking course in Afghani cuisine. "And why is this exciting news?" asked Malcolm, who had never quite forgiven the three of them for their inexplicable dislike of him.
"Well," said J.B., and paused, grinning, "she's transitioning."
"To a man?" asked Malcolm. "Give me a break, J.B. She's never exhibited any gender dysphoric ideations for as long as we've known her." A former co-worker of Malcolm's had transitioned the year before, and Malcolm had become a self-anointed expert on the subject, lecturing them about their intolerance and ignorance, until J.B. had finally shouted at him,
"Jesus, Malcolm, I'm far more trans than Dominic will ever be."
"Well, anyway, she is," J.B. continued, "and the bitches are throwing her a party at their house, and we're all invited." They groaned.
"J.B., I only have 5 weeks before I leave for London, and I have so much shit to get done,"
Willem protested.
"I can't spend a night listening to Edie Kim complaining out in Bushwick."
"You can't not go," shrieked J.B.
"They specifically asked for you. Francesca's inviting some girl who knows you from something or other and wants to see you again. If you don't go, they're all going to think you think you're too good for them now. And there's going to be a ton of other people we haven't seen in forever."
"Yeah, and maybe there's a reason we haven't seen them," Jude said.
"And besides, Willem, the pussy will be waiting for you whether you spend an hour in Brooklyn or not. And it's not like it's the end of the world. It's Bushwick. Judy'll drive us."
Jude had bought a car the year before, and although it wasn't particularly fancy, J.B. loved to ride around in it.
"What? I'm not going," Jude said.
"Why not?"
"I'm in a wheelchair, J.B., remember? And as I recall, Marta and Francesca's place doesn't have an elevator."
"Wrong place," J.B. replied triumphantly.
"See how long it's been? They moved. Their new place definitely has one. A freight elevator, actually."
He leaned back, drumming his fist on the table, as the rest of them sat in a resigned silence.
"And off we go."
So the following Saturday they met at Jude's loft on Green Street, and he drove them to Bushwick, where he circled Marta and Francesca's block, looking for a parking space.
"There was a spot right back there,"
J.B. said after 10 minutes.
"It was a loading zone," Jude told him. "If you just put that handicap sign up, we can park wherever we want,"
J.B. said.
"I don't like using it. You know that. If you're not going to use it, then what's the point of having a car?"
"Jude, I think that's a space," said Willem, ignoring J.B.
7 blocks from the apartment," muttered J.B.
"Shut up, J.B., said Malcolm. Once inside the party, they were each tugged by a different person to a separate corner of the room. Willem watched as Jude was pulled firmly away by Marta.
"Help me," Jude mouthed to him, and he smiled and gave him a little wave.
"Courage," he mouthed back, and Jude rolled his eyes. He knew how much Jude hadn't wanted to come, hadn't wanted to explain again and again why he was in a wheelchair, and yet Willem had begged him.
"Don't make me go alone."
"You won't be alone. You'll be with J.B. and Malcolm."
"You know what I mean. 45 minutes and we're out of there. J.B. and Malcolm can find their own way back to the city if they want to stay longer."
15 minutes.
30.
"Fine." Willem, meanwhile, had been ensnared by Edie Kim, who looked basically the same as she had when they were in college. A little rounder, maybe, but that was it. He hugged her.
"Edie," he said, "congratulations."
"Thanks, Willem," said Edie. She smiled at him.
"You look great. Really, really great."
J.B. had always had a theory that Edie had a crush on him, but he'd never believed it.
"I really loved the Lacuna Detectives. You were really great in it."
"Oh," he said, "thanks." He had hated the Lacuna Detectives. He had despised the production of it so much, the story, which was fantastic, had concerned a pair of metaphysical detectives who entered the unconscious minds of amnesiacs. But the director had been so tyrannical that Willem's co-star had quit 2 weeks into the shoot and had to be recast, and once a day someone had run off the set crying,
that he had never actually seen the film itself.
So, he said, trying to redirect the conversation. Why's Jude in a wheelchair?
Edie asked.
He sighed. When Jude had begun using the wheelchair regularly 2 months ago, the first time he'd had to in 4 years, since he was 31, he had prepped them all on how to respond to this question.
It's not permanent, he said. He just has an infection in his leg and it makes it painful for him to walk long distances.
God, poor guy, said Edie.
Marta says he left the U.S. attorneys and has a huge job at some corporate firm.
J.B. had also always suspected Edie had a crush on Jude, which Willem thought was fairly plausible.
Yeah, for a few years now, he said, eager to move the subject away from Jude, for whom he never liked to answer. He would have loved to talk about Jude, and he knew what he could and couldn't say about him, or on his behalf, but he didn't like the sly, confiding tone people took when asking about him, as if he might be cajoled or tricked into revealing what Jude himself wouldn't, as if he ever would.
Anyway, Edie, this is really exciting for you.
He stopped.
I'm sorry. I should have asked, do you still want to be called Edie?
Edie frowned.
Why wouldn't I?
Well, he paused.
I didn't know how far into the process you were, and
what process?
The transition process?
He should have stopped when he saw Edie's befuddlement, but he didn't.
JB said you were transitioning?
Yeah, to Hong Kong, said Edie, still frowning.
I'm going to be a freelance vegan consultant for a medium-sized hospitality business.
Wait a minute. You thought I was transitioning genders?
Oh, God, he said, and two thoughts, separate but equally resonant, filled his mind.
I am going to kill JB, and I can't wait to tell Jude about this conversation.
Edie, I'm so, so sorry.
He remembered from college that Edie was tricky. Little kid things upset her. He once saw her sobbing because the top scoop of her ice cream cone had tumbled onto her new shoes, but big things, the death of her sister, her screaming, snowball-throwing breakup with her girlfriend, which had taken place in the quad, and which everyone at Hood had leaned out of their windows to witness, seemed to leave her unfazed. He wasn't sure into which category his gaffe fell, and Edie herself appeared equally uncertain, her small mouth convoluting itself into shapes in confusion. Finally, though, she started laughing and called across the room at someone,
Hannah, Hannah, come here, you've got to hear this.
And he exhaled, apologized to and congratulated her again, and made his escape. He started across the room toward Jude. After years, decades almost, of these parties, the two of them had worked out their own sign language, a pantomime whose every gesture meant the same thing, save me, albeit with varying levels of intensity. Usually they were able to simply catch each other's eye across the room and telegraph their desperation, but at parties like this, where the loft was lit only by candles, and the guests seemed to have multiplied themselves in the space of his short conversation with Edie, more expressive body language was often necessary. Grabbing the back of one's neck meant the other person should call him on his phone right away. Fiddling with one's watch band meant, come over here and replace me in this conversation, or at least join in. And yanking down on the left earlobe meant, get me out of this right now. He had seen from the edge of his eye that Jude had been pulling steadily on his earlobe for the past 10 minutes, and he could now see that Marta had been joined by a grim-looking woman he vaguely remembered meeting and disliking at a previous party. The two of them were looming interrogatively over Jude in a way that made them appear proprietary and, in the candlelight, fierce, as if Jude were a child who had just been caught breaking a licorice-edged corner off their gingerbread house, and they were deciding whether to broil him with prunes or bake him with turnips. He tried, he'd later tell Jude, he really did, but he was at one end of the room and Jude was at the other, and he kept getting stopped and tangled in conversations with people he hadn't seen in years, and, more annoyingly, people he had just seen a few weeks ago. As he pressed forward, he waved at Malcolm and pointed in Jude's direction, but Malcolm gave him a helpless shrug and mouthed, "What?" as he made a dismissive gesture back. "Never mind." "I've got to get out of here," he thought, and pushed through the crowd, but the truth was that he usually didn't mind these parties, not really. A large part of him even enjoyed them. He suspected the same might be true of Jude as well, though perhaps to a lesser extent. Certainly he did fine for himself at parties, and people always wanted to talk to him, and although the two of them always complained to each other about J.B. and how he kept dragging them to these things and how tedious they were, they both knew they could simply refuse if they really wanted to, and they both rarely did. After all, where else would they get to use their semaphores? That language that had only two speakers in the whole world. In recent years, as his life had moved further from college and the person he had been, he sometimes found it relaxing to see people from there. He teased J.B. about how he had never really graduated from Hood, but in reality, he admired how J.B. had maintained so many of his and their relationships from then, and how he had somehow managed to contextualize so many of them. Despite his collection of friends from long ago, there was an insistent present tenseness to how J.B. saw and experienced life, and around him, even the most dedicated nostalgists found themselves less inclined to pick over the chaff and glitter of the past, and instead made themselves contend with whoever the person standing before them had become. He also appreciated how the people J.B. had chosen to remain friendly with were largely unimpressed with who he had become, as much as he could be said to have become anyone. Some of them behaved differently around him now, especially in the last year or so, but most of them were dedicated to lives and interests and pursuits that were so specific and, at times, marginal, that Willem's accomplishments were treated as neither more nor less important than their own. J.B.'s friends were poets and performance artists and academics and modern dancers and philosophers. He had, Malcolm once observed, befriended everyone at their college who was least likely to make money, and their lives were grants and residencies and fellowships and awards. Success, among J.B.'s Hood Hall assortment, wasn't defined by your box office numbers, as it was for his agent and manager, or your co-stars or your reviews, as it was by his grad school classmates. It was defined simply and only by how good your work was, and whether you were proud of it. People had actually said that to him at these parties. "Oh, I didn't see Black Mercury 3081, but were you proud of your work in it?" No, he hadn't been proud of it. He had played a brooding intergalactic scientist who was also a jiu-jitsu warrior and who successfully and single-handedly defeated a gargantuan space monster. But he had been satisfied with it. He had worked hard and had taken his performance seriously, and that was all he ever hoped to do. Sometimes he wondered whether he was being fooled, if this entire circle of J.B.'s was a performance art piece in itself, one in which the competitions and concerns and ambitions of the real world, the world that sputtered along on money and greed and envy, were overlooked in favor of the pure pleasure of doing work. Sometimes this felt astringent to him, in the best way. He saw these parties, his time with the Hoodies, as something cleansing and restorative, something that returned him to who he once was, thrilled to get a part in the college production of Noises Off, making his roommates run lines with him every evening. "A career mikveh," said Jude, smiling, when he had told him this. "A free market douche," he countered. "An ambition enema. Ooh, that's good." But sometimes the parties, like tonight's, had the opposite effect. Sometimes he found himself resenting the other's definition of him, the reductiveness and immovability of it. He was, and forever would be, Willem Ragnarsson of Hood Hall Suite 8, someone bad at math and good with girls, an identity both simple and understandable, his persona drawn in two quick brushstrokes. They weren't wrong, necessarily.
There was something depressing about being in an industry in which he was considered an intellectual simply because he didn't read certain magazines and websites and because he had gone to the college he had. But it made his life, which he knew was small anyway, feel smaller still. And sometimes he sensed in his former peers' ignorance of his career something stubborn and willful and begrudging. Last year, when his first truly big studio film had been released, he had been at a party in Red Hook and had been talking to a hood hanger-on who was always at these gatherings, a man named Arthur who'd lived in the loser house, Dillingham Hall, and who now published an obscure but respected journal about digital cartography. "So, Willem, what have you been doing lately?" Arthur asked, finally, after talking for 10 minutes about the most recent issue of The Histories, which had featured a three-dimensional rendering of the Indo-Chinese opium route from 1839 through 1842. He experienced then that moment of disorientation he occasionally had at these gatherings. Sometimes that very question was asked in a jokey, ironic way, as a congratulations, and he would smile and play along. "Oh, not much. Still waiting at Ortolan. We're doing a great sable fish with Tobiko these days." But sometimes people genuinely didn't know. The genuine not knowing happened less and less frequently these days, and when it did, it was usually from someone who lived so far off the cultural grid that even the reading of the New York Times was treated as a seditious act, or, more often, someone who was trying to communicate their disapproval, no, their dismissal, of him and his life and work by remaining determinedly ignorant of it. He didn't know Arthur well enough to know into which category he fell, although he knew him well enough to not like him, the way he pressed so close into his space that he had literally backed into a wall, so he answered simply, "I'm acting." "Really?" said Arthur, blandly. "Anything I'd have heard of?" This question, not the question itself, but Arthur's tone, its carelessness and derision, irritated him anew, but he didn't show it. "Well," he said slowly, "they're mostly indies. I did something last year called The Kingdom of Frankincense, and I'm leaving next month to shoot The Unvanquished, based on the novel." Arthur looked blank. Willem sighed. He had won an award for The Kingdom of Frankincense. "And something I shot a couple of years ago's just been released. This thing called Black Mercury 3081. "Sounds interesting," said Arthur, looking bored. "I don't think I've heard of it, though." "Huh. I'll have to look it up." "Well, good for you, Willem." He hated the way certain people said, "Good for you, Willem," as if his job were some sort of spun sugar fantasy, a fiction he fed himself and others, and not something that actually existed. He especially hated it that night, when not 50 yards away, framed clearly in the window just behind Arthur's head, happened to be a spotlit billboard mounted atop a building with his face on it, his scowling face, admittedly. He was, after all, fighting off an enormous mauve computer-generated alien, and Black Mercury 3081 coming soon in 2-foot-high letters. In those moments, he would be disappointed in the hoodies. "They're no better than anyone else at all," he would realize. "In the end, they're jealous and trying to make me feel bad. And I'm stupid because I do feel bad." Later, he would be irritated with himself. "This is what you wanted," he would remind himself. "So why do you care what other people think?" But acting was caring what other people thought. Sometimes it felt like that was all it was. And as much as he liked to think himself immune to other people's opinions, as if he was somehow above worrying about them, he clearly wasn't. "I know it sounds so fucking petty," he told Jude after that party. He was embarrassed by how annoyed he was. He wouldn't have admitted it to anyone else. "It doesn't sound petty at all," Jude had said. They were driving back to the city from Red Hook. "But Arthur's a jerk, Willem. He always has been. And years of studying Herodotus hasn't made him any less of one." He smiled reluctantly. "I don't know," he said. "Sometimes I feel there's something so
so pointless about what I do. How can you say that, Willem? You're an amazing actor. You really are. And you don't say I bring joy to so many people. Actually, I wasn't going to say that. Your films aren't really the sorts of things that bring joy to anyone. Willem had come to specialize in playing dark and complicated characters, often quietly violent, usually morally compromised, that inspired different degrees of sympathy. Ragnarsson the Terrible, Harold called him. Except aliens, of course.
Right, except aliens.
Although not even them. You kill them all in the end, don't you? But Willem, I love watching them, and so do many other people. That's got to count for something, right? How many people get to say that, that they can actually remove someone from his daily life? And when he didn't answer, you know, maybe we should stop going to these parties. They're becoming unhealthy exercises in masochism and self-loathing for us both.
Jude turned to him and grinned.
At least you're in the arts. I might as well be working for an arms dealer. Dorothy Wharton asked me tonight how it felt waking up each morning knowing I'd sacrificed yet another piece of my soul the day before.
Finally, he laughed.
No, she didn't. Yes, she did. It was like having a conversation with Harold.
Yeah, if Harold was a white woman with dreadlocks.
Jude smiled. As I said, like having a conversation with Harold.
But really, both of them knew why they kept attending these parties, because they had become one of the few opportunities the four of them had to be together. And at times, they seemed to be their only opportunity to create memories the four of them could share, keeping their friendship alive by dropping bundles of kindling onto a barely smoldering black smudge of fire. It was their way of pretending everything was the same. It also provided them an excuse to pretend that everything was fine with JB, when they all three knew that something wasn't. Willem couldn't quite identify what was wrong with him. JB could be, in his way, almost as evasive as Jude when it came to certain conversations, but he knew that JB was lonely and unhappy and uncertain, and that none of those sensations were familiar ones to him. He sensed that JB, who had so loved college, its structures and hierarchies and micro-societies that he had known how to navigate so well, was trying with every party to recreate the easy, thoughtless companionship they had once had, when their professional identities were still foggy to them and they were united by their aspirations instead of divided by their daily realities. So he organized these outings, and they all obediently followed as they had always done, giving him the small kindness of letting him be the leader, the one who decided for them, always. He would have liked to have seen JB one-on-one, just the two of them. But these days, when he wasn't with his college friends, JB ran with a different crowd, one consisting mostly of art world hangers-on, who seemed to be only interested in doing lots of drugs and then having dirty sex, and it simply wasn't appealing to him. He was in New York less and less often, just 8 months in the past 3 years, and when he was home, there were the twin and contradictory pressures to spend meaningful time with his friends and to do absolutely nothing at all. Now, though, he kept moving toward Jude, who had at least been released by Marta and her grouchy friend and was talking to their friend Carolina. Seeing this, he felt guilty anew, as he hadn't talked to Carolina in months, and he knew she was angry with him. When Francesca blocked his path to reintroduce him to a woman named Rachel, with whom he had worked 4 years ago on a production of Cloud Nine, for which she had been the assistant dramaturge. He was happy enough to see her again. He had liked her all those years ago. He had always thought she was pretty. But he knew, even as he was talking to her, that it would go no further than a conversation. After all, he hadn't been exaggerating. He started filming in 5 weeks. Now was not the time to get ensnared in something new and complicated, and he didn't really have the energy for a one-night hookup, which, he knew, had a funny way of becoming as exhausting as something longer term. 10 minutes or so into his conversation with Rachel, his phone buzzed, and he apologized and checked the message from Jude. Leaving.
Don't want to interrupt your conversation with the future Mrs. Ragnarsson. See you at home. Shit, he said. And then to Rachel, sorry. Suddenly the spell of the party ended, and he was desperate to leave. Their participation in these parties were a kind of theater that the four of them agreed to stage for themselves, but once one of the actors left the stage, there seemed little point in continuing. He said goodbye to Rachel, whose expression changed from perplexed to hostile once she realized he was truly leaving and she wasn't being invited to leave with him, and then to a group of other people, Marta, Francesca, J.B., Malcolm, Edie, Carolina, at least half of whom seemed deeply annoyed with him. It took him another 30 minutes to extricate himself from the apartment, and on his way downstairs he texted Jude back, hopefully, "You still here? Leaving now." And then, when he didn't get a reply, "Taking train. Picking something up at the apartment. See you soon." He took the L to 8th Avenue and then walked the few blocks south to his apartment. Late October was his favorite time in the city, and he was always sad to miss it. He lived on the corner of Perry and West 4th, in a third-floor unit whose windows were just level with the tops of the ginkgo trees. Before he'd moved in, he'd had a vision that he would lie in bed late on the weekends and watch the tornado the yellow leaves made as they were shaken loose from their branches by the wind. But he never had. He had no special feelings for the apartment, other than it was his and he had bought it. The first and biggest thing he had ever bought after paying off the last of his student loans. When he had begun looking, a year and a half ago, he had known only that he wanted to live downtown and that he needed a building with an elevator so that Jude would be able to visit him. "Isn't that a little codependent?" his girlfriend at the time, Philippa, had asked him, teasing, but also not teasing. "Is it?" he had asked, understanding what she meant, but pretending not to. "Willem," Philippa had said, laughing to conceal her irritation, "it is." He had shrugged, unoffended. "I can't live somewhere he can't come visit," he said. She sighed. "I know." He knew that Philippa had nothing against Jude. She liked him, and Jude liked her as well, and had even one day gently told Willem that he thought he should spend more time with Philippa when he was in town. When he and Philippa had begun dating, she was a costume designer, mostly for theater, she had been amused, charmed even, by his friendships. She had seen them, he knew, as proof of his loyalty and dependability and consistency. But as they continued dating, as they got older, something changed, and the amount of time he spent with J.B. and Malcolm, and especially Jude, became evidence instead of his fundamental immaturity, his unwillingness to leave behind the comfort of one life, the life with them, for the uncertainties of another, with her. She never asked him to abandon them completely. Indeed, one of the things he had loved about her was how close she was to her own group of friends, and that the two of them could spend a night with their own people, in their own restaurants, having their own conversations, and then meet at its end, two distinct evenings ending as a single shared one. But she wanted, finally, a kind of surrender from him, a dedication to her and their relationship that superseded the others, which he couldn't bring himself to do. But he felt he had given more to her than she recognized. In their last 2 years together, he hadn't gone to Harold and Julia's for Thanksgiving, nor to the Irvines at Christmas, so he could instead go to her parents in Vermont. He had forgone his annual vacation with Jude. He had accompanied her to her friends' parties and weddings and dinners and shows, and had stayed with her when he was in town, watching as she sketched designs for a production of The Tempest, sharpening her expensive colored pencils while she slept, and he, his mind still stuck in a different time zone, wandered through the apartment, starting and stopping books, opening and closing magazines, idly straightening the containers of pasta and cereal in the pantry. He had done all of this happily and without resentment, but it still hadn't been enough, and they had broken up, quietly and, he thought,
Well, the previous year, after almost 4 years together. Mr. Irvine, hearing that they had broken up, shook his head. This had been at Flora's baby shower. You boys are really turning into a bunch of Peter Pans, he said. Willem, what are you, 36? I'm not sure what's going on with you lot. You're making money. You've achieved something. Don't you think you guys should stop clinging to one another and get serious about adulthood? But how was one to be an adult? Was couplehood truly the only appropriate option? But then, a soul option was no option at all. Thousands of years of evolutionary and social development, and this is our only choice? He'd asked Harold when they were up in Truro this past summer, and Harold had laughed. Look, Willem, he said, I think you're doing just fine. I know I give you a hard time about settling down, and I agree with Malcolm's dad that couplehood is wonderful. But all you really have to do is just be a good person, which you already are, and enjoy your life. You're young. You have years and years to figure out what you want to do and how you want to live. And what if this is how I want to live? Well, then that's fine, said Harold. He smiled at Willem. You boys are living every man's dream, you know. Probably even John Irvine's. Lately, he had been wondering if codependence was such a bad thing. He took pleasure in his friendships, and it didn't hurt anyone, so who cared if it was codependent or not? And anyway, how was a friendship any more codependent than a relationship? Why was it admirable when you were 27, but creepy when you were 37? Why wasn't friendship as good as a relationship? Why wasn't it even better? It was two people who remained together day after day, bound not by sex or physical attraction or money or children or property, but only by the shared agreement to keep going, the mutual dedication to a union that could never be codified. Friendship was witnessing another's slow drip of miseries and long bouts of boredom and occasional triumphs. It was feeling honored by the privilege of getting to be present for another person's most dismal moments, and knowing that you could be dismal around him in return. More troubling to him than his possible immaturity, though, were his capabilities as a friend. He had always taken pride in the fact that he was a good friend. Friendship had always been important to him. But was he actually any good at it? There was the unresolved JB problem, for example. A good friend would have figured something out. And a good friend would certainly have figured out a better way to deal with Jude, instead of telling himself, chant-like, that there simply was no better way to deal with Jude. And if there was, if someone, Andy, Harold, anyone, could figure out a plan, then he'd be happy to follow it. But even as he told himself this, he knew that he was just making excuses for himself. Andy knew it, too. 5 years ago, Andy had called him in Sophia and yelled at him. It was his first shoot. It had been very late at night, and from the moment he answered the phone and heard Andy say, "For someone who claims to be such a great friend, you sure as fuck haven't been around to prove it," he had been defensive, because he knew Andy was right. "Wait a minute," he said, sitting upright, fury and fear clearing away any residual sleepiness. "He's sitting at home, fucking cutting himself to shreds. He's essentially all scar tissue now. He looks like a fucking skeleton, and where are you, Willem?" asked Andy. "And don't say I'm on a shoot. Why aren't you checking in on him?" "I'd call him every single day," he began, yelling himself. "You knew this was going to be hard for him," Andy continued, talking over him. "You knew the adoption was going to make him feel more vulnerable. So why didn't you put any safeguards in place, Willem? Why aren't your other so-called friends doing anything?" "Because he doesn't want them to know that he cuts himself, that's why. And I didn't know that it was going to be this hard for him, Andy," he said. "He never tells me anything. How was I supposed to know?" "Because you're supposed to fucking use your brain, Willem. Don't you fucking shout at me," he shouted. "You're just mad, Andy, because he's your patient and you can't fucking figure out a way to make him better, and so you're blaming me." He regretted it the moment he said it, and in that instant they were both silent, panting into their phones. "Andy," he began. "Nope," said Andy. "You're right, Willem. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No, he said. I'm sorry. He was abruptly miserable, thinking of Jude in the ugly Lispenard Street bathroom. Before he had left, he had looked everywhere for